Professor.
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. We have a quorum to conduct business, and let the record reflect that the time is currently 9:08 a.m. on Thursday, April 12th, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Foster, so that makes seven. Before we start, folks could mute their cell phones. And at this meeting today, we'll have three bills before the committee, SB 126, which is visiting physicians with sports teams, SB 105, marital and family therapy licenses and services, and SB 158, oil hazardous substance cleanup and reimbursements. So our first bill up today is SB 126, which is visiting physicians with sports teams by Senator McKinnon. And we have Ms. Julia Lucky here. Just also note that Co-Chair Seaton is also here. And so this is the first time the committee has heard this bill, but if it is the will of the committee, we could move the bill today. And so at this time, looks like we've got Ms. Lucky here. If you could put yourself on the record and go ahead and introduce the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Lucky, and I am staff to Senator Anna McKinnon. She sends her apologies. She is working on other state business. I believe she is chairing your like committee right now, but I did not actually see them gavel in. I know that your time is precious these days, and this is a very, very short bill, and so my presentation will also be short, and I can get to any questions the committee might have. This bill was brought to us by a constituent who is an orthopedic surgeon and is also a representative to the National Council of Orthopedic Surgery and Sports Medicine. It is part of a nationwide effort to provide certainty for sports teams' physicians that are actually licensed in another state and traveling with that sports team to compete in other states. Senate Bill 126 would add an additional exemption for physicians, and this is specified in the law, that are licensed in another state, under contract with an athletic team from that state, and traveling to, from, or in Alaska while they are participating in that sporting event, and they can only treat members of that team. We believe this is a very small problem that affects a very small number of people, and the exemption is very specific. And with that, I will be happy to answer any questions. The bill is only two sections. The first section would be what I just explained, the language that allows that exemption. And the second section is just a conforming amendment that renumbers some the exemptions.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So will they be required to fill out any kind of paperwork or just have that information on them in case asked at a hospital? Because, I mean, I would imagine that would be when someone would ask if something happened.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the Board of Medicine, I don't know if they are online, they would have to determine how that would be done through regulation. However, our understanding was that they would not have to do any additional paperwork. And I just want to point out, this does not confer them any hospital privileges. It is mostly the problem they have had is if you have a small injury, maybe a sprain, obviously, if there's a problem that needs to go to a clinic or an emergency room, that team member would go there regardless of whether they were traveling with their physician. And the physician would not be able to work in a hospital. But the most common concern that we have had is that if an athlete might leave maybe without their asthma inhaler or some needed medication, that their team physician is unable to get them a prescription when they come to the state, and they would have to partner with an Alaska physician to do that, or they would have to go to a clinic, and if they're only coming up for 48 hours to compete in a, you know, some sort of sporting event, that becomes a little problematic for them. So this would just ease the ability for their physician to treat them on those sort of things.
Thank you.
And just so the committee knows, we do have a Deborah Stovern here. She is the executive administrator, Alaska State Medical Board, Department of Commerce. She's online calling in from Anchorage if there are questions for her. So with that, are there any other questions of the committee, Representative Thompson, and then Ortiz?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It's lucky, out of curiosity, we have athletic teams that have the team doctor travel with them to destinations in the lower 48. How do other states handle this? Are they reciprocal?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the idea is to get this bill passed in all 50 states, and I believe that our constituent, Mr. or Dr. Moore, is online and would have better numbers for us. It is our understanding, as of the last time we checked, all the states except for two are either putting forth legislation or have already passed legislation at this time.
Thank you.
Okay, and Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lucky, can you tell me a little bit more about the specific issue that was that caused this constituent to bring this forward? Was there, just so they can understand how these things work, what was the issue that caused the physician to bring this to your attention? Do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the constituent is online, and it might be better to hear directly from him, if that would be your preference.
Sure. Sure. Mr. Chairman?
Sure. And Dr. Jeff Moore, is that correct? If you're online, if you could put yourself on the record.
Sure. My name's Jeff Moore. I'm an orthopedic surgeon here in Anchorage, Alaska. So and, to answer your questions, I'm the national delegate for the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine. This has been a national program for them trying to get this passed in every state. So it's currently passed in 35 states. It's pending in our state as well as 13 other states. And so the idea was trying to get it reciprocity in every state so that traveling team physicians can take care of their teams because they know those patients the best. And as Julie pointed out, it's fairly simple things. They're not going to be able to, they won't have hospital privilege. They're not going to do anything like surgery or anything like that. It would just be taking care of simple things with their team. So that's how I got involved. And what was the other question? I'm sorry.
Representative Ortiz.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm correct then in understanding that this effort is not a result of a specific issue that developed here in Alaska on a particular case where a doctor was limited in what they would be able to do because they didn't have this clinic. So this is just more of a national effort to kind of standardize the rights, for lack of a better word, for visiting physicians. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Got it. Thanks.
Okay. Next up, we have Representative Guttenberg and then Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the doctor, Dr. Moore?
Yes.
I mean, it seems like a simple, good idea, but I'm learning about the mechanics of it. And the example that Ms. Lucky pointed out, so the doctor, the traveling doctor with the team, somebody lost their asthma inhaler, writes a prescription, the team member goes in, the pharmacist says, this doctor's not in Alaska. How does that work? Do the pharmacists understand that? Will this be a generally understood, even though it's kind of very narrow focus, understood across the pharmacy world or the medical? Will this kind of be something that's written into their dialogue?
So it would really be, you know, for simple things like this, you know, say somebody came in, had like a skin infection, needed some antibiotics, was just acutely infected and they needed a prescription. Technically, the traveling team doctor that's not from the state can't prescribe those things out of state. This would sort of level that so that they could do it. Otherwise, they would have to call, say, me, or, you know, if I was in state here, or somebody that was around to say, hey, I'm the team doc here, and I need to get this prescription done. That would be typically what we'd be looking at. If they had a major injury, they're still going to be going to the emergency room and getting evaluated. And then if it needed some kind of surgery, most of those, and I've had, I was the team doc for the Alaska Aces of the Day here in town. We would have those, you know, folks come back if we could. Sometimes they still had to get treated out of state, and that would be the doc that was in the state. So if we had a major injury here, I might take care of them if it was, they needed surgery. But so that wouldn't be an issue. Did that answer your question?
Maybe it did, but let me restate it again. Somebody lost their luggage and their asthma inhaler was in it. The team is in the hotel. Somebody says, I need an inhaler. The traveling doctor writes them a prescription. Instead of calling you or the hospital or a clinic, first care clinic, are they going to be able to do that? I have no problem with that. I'm just wondering how it would work.
Yes. This bill would allow that.
And how would the pharmacist know?
They still would have to have a DEA license. So they would still have to have a DEA number. That's a national number. So if they called the pharmacist could say, well, I need your DEA number. They could get that. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, this is something that is new for me, so that makes sense. Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. This is for Dr. Moore also. Just along the same lines, would a physician would not have inpatient admission credentials, but they would they have the ability to write an order for an X-ray or for other other things like that?
So they wouldn't, you're right, they would not have any inpatient or hospital privileges. Getting an X-ray, they might be a little tricky. If they were at an urgent care place, they would just probably have, they would still have to get somebody else involved probably to do something like an X-ray. Just because you would need an order and you'd have to have hospital privileges to do that order. But in an urgent care, you could probably talk to, there's somebody going to be manning that anyway. They would probably just discuss with them about the X-rays.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And do we have any further questions? I don't see any further questions. So with that, let's go over to public testimony, now open on SB 126. And just for folks who may be watching, you can email your public testimony to housefinance@akleg.gov. Again, housefinance@akleg.gov. And so is there anybody in the room who would like to testify? I don't see anybody. And Dr. Jeff Moore, I see you're down as being available for public testimony. If you would like to do so, if you could just put yourself on the record again.
Sure. I'm just whatever I had mentioned before is what I had said.
Okay. Sounds like you're here available for questions mostly. So if you don't have anything further, that brings us back to the bill. We'll close public testimony on SB 126. And with that, let's see here. I guess is the committee, I don't know if there are any amendments, and if there are not, then we could go ahead and move the bill out. I would entertain a motion then. And actually, let's go back to the fiscal note. Vice Chair Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a one-time $2,500 cost, which I would guess is regulations. It is regulations. Yeah, $2,500 to get the regulations in place, no cost afterwards. So then the bill becomes free.
I have a question.
Oh, OMB component number 2360 is the fiscal note, and it's from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing.
And we've got a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. And I don't know if the department's here or actually even Ms. Lucky, but we see a variety of different fiscal notes that are de minimis, $2,500, $7,500, $5,000 for change of regs, legal notice, you know, and the dialogue is worth knowing how many different types of reg change, what does it cost for a reg change or public notice to get something done legally, and because we see so many of these that are almost de minimis, and what does the 2.5 represent in this case?
And through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, while I did come back up here, I believe that Ms. Stovern is online from the department, and if she is not, then I am happy to address that question.
Ms. Stovern, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Deborah Stovern. I am with the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Division of Professional Licensing, and as noted, I am the Executive Administrator for the State Medical Board. And the answer to that question is yes, that is correct. This represents a small regulations project. This is the estimate for doing the public notice and the legal work for the board to adopt regulations to implement this statute change.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but that doesn't quite address my...
Representative Guttenberg.
Across the board, we have things that appear to be as small as this for legal notices, but the costs vary quite a bit in that small range. I don't know why, or sometimes it's they're paying another department to do some work for them, legal notices or advertising it. Oh, here we go.
And if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janie McCullough. I'm the Division Director for Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, we break out the costs of these to implement regulations with like-type previous regulation projects, and this will allow us to spend the money on behalf of the licensees and gives us that spending authority. Does that make sense?
Representative Guttenberg?
I understand that. I guess maybe this is across the departments. We see such a variety of numbers in this case, right? So it's de minimis. It's nothing. It's just going to do reg change or public notice. What is the difference between all of them? Are there more requirements for one than another?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, it does vary. It depends on how many interested parties are on the list. Mailing out of these regulations to those interested parties, to licensees that are affected by the regulation change so that they can weigh in on it. In this particular case, there are 731 people that would be affected by this that we estimate at 49 cents. There is the legal costs to review the regulations, and then the advertising alone for a like project. This is really a medium-sized project, and we can only speak to our regulations. Newspaper ad would be $772, that kind of thing. Is that the detail that you want?
Yeah, that's close enough. Thank you.
Do we have any further questions on the fiscal notes?
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Ms. Lucky?
And for the record, this is Julie Lucky again. I did want to point out that these are receipt supported services, so there's no general fund money in the regulations update.
Thank you. Any further questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none, Representative Kerr?
No, I thought maybe I could learn everything I want to know about fiscal notes on this bill, too. Just, do you mind? Could we keep you here till like noon?
I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 126, version 30LS1016/J from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, SB 126, version 30-LS1016/J is reported out from House Finance with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the report. Back on record, and the next bill up today is SB 105, which is marital and family therapy licenses and services by Senator Wilson. And at this hearing, we will get an introduction of the bill, and if it is the will of the committee, actually, I've gotten word that we may have an amendment, so we'll just kind of play it by ear here. So at this time, I'd like to call Senator Wilson and his aide Gary Zepp to the table. And I'd also like to ask Representative Sponholds to join Senator Wilson since she carried the companion bill, HB 353, here on the House side. And so with that, Senator Wilson, welcome. Do you have any, or if you could put yourself on the record and if you have any opening statements?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator David Wilson, Senator for District D. I believe I will let Rep. Sponholds begin, if that's okay with the Chair.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Representative Ivy Sponholz, representing District 16 in East Anchorage. And SB 106 is the companion bill to HB 353 that I'm carrying. And substantively, what the bill does is it updates and clarifies the supervisory requirements for licensed marital and family therapists. This is important because it allows them to become eligible for Medicaid reimbursement. The purpose for this is to increase access to behavioral health care in the state of Alaska at a time when we have really an acute shortage of behavioral health care providers. We expect, while there is a there's a modest fiscal note, we expect actually over the long term, maybe even in the midterm, that it will reduce health care costs by allowing more people who are struggling with behavioral health issues to get access to health care before it becomes an acute problem and they need to go to the emergency department. And I just want to clarify that it's not an expansion of Medicaid. It's just opening up one more door for the population that we're already covering to access health care. In the state of Alaska, there are approximately 85 licensed medical and family therapists in the state of Alaska, so this is a fairly small population. But I think anything that we can do to increase access to behavioral health care in the state of Alaska when we know we have a very serious shortage is a constructive step in the right direction.
Thank you. And again, this is David Wilson, Senator of District D. I just want to briefly go over some of the issues and items with marital family and therapy folks. So this SB 105, marital family licensed therapy, involves a professional application of assessments, treatments, of psychotherapy services to individuals, couples, and families for the purpose of treating and diagnosing emotional and mental disorders. Currently, as Respond Holtz stated, that these folks are only allowed to provide behavioral health treatment to community health clinics, physician mental health clinics, which limits the numbers of willing providers. SB 105 will again expand the medical assistance reimbursable services to cover provided to providers directly or independently by the marital licensed therapist. SB 105 defines the hours of provision for training. It expands lists of approved healthcare providers that can provide group supervision of an associate marital family licensed therapist. It adds the eligible services again to bill Medicaid services. And SB 105 dovetails nicely with the senators from District N's SB 169 by expanding the behavioral health services to Alaskans. And that bill removes a 30% of on-site requirement for supervision and provides a telecommunication device for options for supervision as well. So you guys may want why SB 105? SB 105 really deals with the shortage of healthcare professionals. This was something that was going to be covered a couple of years ago through SB 74 to expand the services of behavioral health providers and treatment options and services. Somehow this was left off. The regulations were being drafted by the department at the time, but the statute wasn't there to allow this. So this is also additional cleanup piece of language for SB 74. And it also dovetails nicely with where we're at with the Department of Health and Social Services 1115 waiver to help expand the services of behavioral health as part of their items. And they state in their sort of background description of where we're at that the challenges of Alaska's behavioral health systems extends beyond the physical crisis. The gaps in behavioral health services exist through the state, due in large part because of the geographical nature, the vast nature and size, limited road system, the climate, and significantly with the challenges of recruitment and retention for qualified behavioral health care workforce. As Respond Holtz stated, this trying to expand the nature of the qualified workforce is vastly. We have folks that are online, I believe, from the Alaska Primary Care Association that can also talk to you about the recruitment costs of trying to find, let's say, a licensed clinical social worker. It could cost up to about $60,000 to $100,000 and can take about 6 months to a year to fill, where you comparatively for a licensed mental health therapist, recruitment cost is around $20,000 to $40,000. So, and they're more plentiful available, and they're also equally as qualified going through their time as well through licensure. Their hour supervision is very comparable to a licensed social worker. With that, if the committee wouldn't mind, I would like to ask Mr. Zepp to come up to if the committee wants a sectional.
Mr. Zepp, if you could put yourself on the record.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Gary Zepp, staff to Senator David Wilson. And we just have a short PowerPoint here. Then obviously you had it yesterday, and I just wanted to hit a couple of the highlights, if that's okay. I'm not going to reiterate what Representative Sponholz and Senator Wilson has already spoken to, but I think you can see what the definition is of behavioral health. That's the umbrella considered. You hear terms behavioral health, mental health. Behavioral health is the umbrella, if you will, over top of all of those types of issues. And At the national level, I think we all recognize that we have some great needs for mental health services. And again, I won't go through all the list there. I think you folks can see that. I think the one thing I'll mention based on this slide and also a couple others is that early intervention in some of these instances can truly help prevent crisis in the emergency room at a much higher cost to prevent incarceration and also perhaps prevent institutionalizing someone. Oh, thank you. Page down. Oh, we don't have a, pardon me.
Page one, page two.
It's the arrows. There you go.
Technical difficulties.
Oh, it's only one page.
We can should be five pages. Slides.
There you go.
There should be five.
Family and technical health therapy.
Let's just go through that.
Okay. If we could turn to slide two in your PowerPoint deck there. I apologize we can't get it up on the screen, but this goes over some of Alaska's behavioral health needs. And again, I won't read the list to you because you have it in front of you. Some of the striking things that we all are aware of is Alaska's suicide rate, as an example, is double the national average. We have a large population of Alaskans that need behavioral health services, but only a small portion of those folks actually receive the services. And I think the correctional institution, the population representation of folks who have behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse is extremely high. I think we all recognize that. One of the interesting things that we learned along the way is, as an example of the costly crisis end of behavioral health, the Mat-Su Regional Emergency Room in 2016 spent $43.8 million, and I'll say that again, $48.3 million on 3,443 patients. That's about $12,721. That's the average cost per person that they've seen. And this doesn't include the additional cost for law enforcement, dispatch, or for ambulance services. And there is a, as Representative Sponholz and Senator Wilson has already indicated, there is a huge shortage of healthcare providers for behavioral health. And this is a measured approach to try and get the Maryland Family Therapists into that group. And so you can see, again, we have a shortage of psychiatrists, of marital and family therapists, and if we can go to slide three. And what is Senate Bill 105? If enacted, the proposed legislation would add a licensed marital and family therapist to the list of independent practitioners to address the shortage of Medicaid-eligible behavioral health providers in the state, afford more options for beneficiaries, and increase access to behavioral health care. Currently, licensed marital and family therapists are only allowed to provide services in community health clinics or physician mental health clinics, which limits the number of willing providers for behavioral health services. Senate Bill 105 expands medical assistance reimbursement services to cover those services provided directly or independently by a licensed marital and family therapist. And specifically, Senate Bill 105 defines the supervision, training hours, and requirements for an associate marital and family therapist. And this will create a path for an associate to become a fully licensed marital and family therapist. And what the bill contains is it clarifies 1,700 hours of clinical contact. And of that, 100 hours must be an individual supervision and 100 hours of group supervision. And you'll notice in the bill in Section 2 there that we've expanded the list of providers, and it's on page 3 of your bill there, lines 5 through 13. And we've added six different professional health care providers that can provide group supervision to these associates that are trying to reach the level of a fully licensed marital and family therapist, which, again, should help expand that pool of 85 that we currently have. And currently, all supervisors must be approved by the board. And so it's a bottleneck for those that group of providers. And lastly, as already has been previously mentioned, but it adds the marital and family therapist services as eligible to render and bill Medicaid services as independent practitioners as well. And if we turn to slide four, And it just has a few highlights on here. Expanding the Medicaid services to include licensed marital family therapists, it really does provide an opportunity to intervene early for to help Alaskans so they don't end up in an expensive emergency room setting or a costly institutional setting. And one example that we've learned along the way here from the Mat-Su Regional Hospital was, and these are approximates, but the private clinical hourly cost is approximately $150 an hour. The Mat-Su put together some numbers for me, and as you can see, it's their average is $4,370 for an average one-time emergency room behavioral health assessment. And I think, and when you think about in terms of the bill itself, the Medicaid clients are already showing up in the emergency rooms. So a portion of these people are already being paid for through Medicaid at a much higher rate. And so hopefully this will allow a less costly option for those emergency room folks and for referrals in general. And I think by increasing the number of healthcare professionals, obviously it can help provide services for those who currently cannot receive services or to reduce those waiting lists that people are on, which sometimes could be, we've heard, 4, 6, 9 months sometimes for a waiting list. It can improve Alaskans' incomes for their health and reduce spending on physical health issues as well. And by adding those additional healthcare professionals to the group supervision, again, this should add more fully licensed marital and family therapists to help out. And I'll turn to slide 5 now. And this is, we have a lot of support from the Alaska Board of Marital and Family Therapy, from the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, the Mat-Su Health Foundation, from the American College of Emergency Physicians, the Alaska chapter, and various Alaska emergency room physicians. And that covers the overview of the bill. If you would like, I could cover a sectional or a summary of changes, whatever you folks would like.
Thank you. I think we are okay on the sectional. And also, as we go into questions, I just want to mention that, well, first of all, just for the record, we were joined by Representatives Tilton and Grin earlier. And also available for questions, we have Randall Burns, Division of Behavioral Health, Rick Calcutt, Mental Health Clinician, Division of Behavioral Health, and Margaret Brody, Director of the Division of Healthcare Services. So with that, we do have a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, when I see a bill like this, well, the first thing I say is, who did we leave off, right? I mean, who do we... Is there somebody else that we should bring in that's covered under these services? And sometimes the bill can get too heavy, right? So really the question, I understand the need, that goes without saying, the ability, people going into the waiting rooms the emergency rooms is by far the most expensive way you can deal with these problems. Really the question I have is, who set the standards for the hours? Are these, I mean, how much of it do we have to conform to national or Medicaid services, or where do the hours and the supervision requirements come from?
For the record, Gary Zepp, staff to Senator David Wilson, through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. Those are the hours and the guidelines for training is established by the Board of Marital and Family Therapy, the Alaska Board here.
So this just conforms to the standard. And has there been any... I mean, we go through this with all kinds of vocations, and has there been any feedback from the folks? I mean, right now they all have to be supervised in a clinic or under an existing doctor, and this allows them to work independently of that. Has there been any feedback from those folks? Is too much, not enough? They don't need supervision, or just asking?
Sure. Again, Gary Zepp for the record. We have Dr. Ken McCarty on the, I believe he's available for answering questions, and he used to be the past president of the Board of Marital and Family Therapists, and perhaps he could probably give a little more expanded answer on that.
And Mr. Ken McCarty, if you could put yourself on the record, and if you need the question repeated, we can do that. Otherwise, go ahead and answer it.
Yeah, this is Ken McCarty from Eagle River. Through the chair, The and I was on the regulatory board for 6 years and president of the association for three. The language is only clarifying the spirit of what was desired. In the past, or the current, what it stands is 1,500 hours of clinical time, and in addition to that, they have to have 200 hours of supervision, 100 hours of individual, 100 hours of group. The way it's written in the statute now has caused confusion, and so this will just make it clear that it's a total of 1,700 hours, of which 200 hours is supervised, 100 hours individual, 100 hours group. So that's what that is just really all about, just making it cleaner and clearer. The part with the additional supervisors, other professions to do group supervision is what the regulatory board was dealing with. The people were like up in Barrow or Nome or Kotzebue or even Seward, and they could not get group supervision by a marriage family therapist because there was no licensed supervisor MFT in those areas. So we saw people that were completing all their hours except for that 100 hour of group, and they would forego their license and pursue something else. So that was the only anomaly. There wasn't an issue of them getting group supervision because there would be these licensed professionals in Barrow, Nome, Seward, whatever, that they were doing groups every week. So now, by acknowledging them, it takes care of that issue of group supervision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to make sure that no one considered this, the hours too high. I mean, the geographic is an issue, right? There's nobody in Barrow or somewhere else to get the supervision, but I wanted to make sure that the people looking to enter into here don't consider the hours a barrier or why it would be or thank you, Mr. Chair.
With the, through the chair, that someone that's a supervisor, like I'm a supervisor, and I'll have an associate, let's say, in Barrow, I could do the individual supervision through them with contract agreements with Barrow and such to do the supervision. But when it comes down to the group, I can't do the group because I need to have a group to, you know, exist for that, and there's only one person, let's say, up there. But now with this, if this is the favor to pass, then it will solve that problem. The person up in Barrow, I was just up there last month speaking at a conference, and the person up in Barrow could go to one of these other supervising clinicians to get their hours, and they already are doing supervision up there, so now they just could capture those that supervision.
Thank you.
Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster, Co-Chair Foster. I just want to also sort of clarify and reiterate this fact. We are not changing the number of hours of supervision required or, you know, hours to become a licensed medical family therapist at all. The we're clarifying the language here to make it more clear to people that are reading the statute that it's 1,700 hours total. The one change that we're making to supervision here is that we now are allowing multiple supervisors to to be allowed to for the supervision hours, the 100 supervision hours that have to be there. We're allowing for multiple supervisors so that it doesn't have to be the same supervisor through the whole process. There are times when in rural communities, as was just explained, that that's not practical, and it allows for supervision to take place using multiple different supervisors, which is just going to help to increase the number of qualified, licensed medical family therapists. But we are not changing the total number of hours. There is no objection to this. There's been no negative feedback whatsoever about it.
Great. Thank you, Representative Sponholz. Before we go to questions, I just wanted to note, looks like we have a fine group of young folks here, and I just wanted to say welcome, and I got the feeling that maybe this might be these might be constituents of Representative Tilton's, and I was going to ask that question, but I got a note saying that it was, and Representative Tilton, if you'd like to maybe introduce them and just let me know who they are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we'd just like to welcome. These are the students and parents and teachers from Academy Charter School, which is in the Matsu Borough. And we just want to welcome them here today. They're here just seeing how government works. They're future leaders, and they're getting their lessons early.
Thank you. And I'm glad to see you here in House Finance, and I hope you enjoy your visit here. The next question goes to Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is another optional service that we're going to be adding to the already list, because on page 3, section 3, it says, in addition to the mandatory services, and then it specified in this section, the department may offer only the following optional services, and then that is where this is inserted.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I just want to clarify, we're not adding an optional service. We're adding the option for marital and family therapy services to be offered. We're not expanding optional services. We're just adding the marital and family practitioners to the range of options. Maybe not. That's not as clear.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
But that would be an option. Because it says these are, it says may offer only the following optional services. So if they weren't listed, I'm assuming that this probably is where they have to be listed to be able to then be able to get Medicaid payments.
Yeah. Through
Senator
the
chair. Wilson?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilson, for the record. Representative Wilson, this is adding just that piece of marital family therapists to be able to bill. So we're not expanding sort of Medicaid optional services. We're allowing them to be able to bill for the services rendered that they would not be able to bill for unless they were in a community mental health clinic. And so this just allows them to expand that service so they don't have to be in those subset of categories to be able to bill for Medicaid services.
Follow up. But without this language in here to make them optional service, then they would not be allowed to be paid, because right now they are not. I mean, that's the whole reason for the bill, from my understanding, is to include them for Medicaid payments on that. So the way it reads to me is it's an optional service. But getting over to the fiscal note, which is a bigger concern that I have, is that this is $1 million fiscal note. And so I'm trying to figure out what increases, because first of all, it's actual federal receipts, which is $660 million. The general fund match, the $340,300,000, is real money because it's not receipt. I'm just trying to, and maybe this is a Margaret Brody question, where they came up with 1,581 recipients that perhaps maybe isn't, I'm sorry, that's 1,581,000 per 1,581, sorry, we get to millions and billions sometimes here, per recipient cost. I'm just trying to figure out where did they get the 633 recipients that are referred to in this fiscal note that was written by Randall Burns and approved by Shonda O'Brien. So if there's somebody online that might be able to help us through this fiscal note.
And is that a Margaret Brody?
For the record, Gary, is that we should have Margaret Brody and Rick from HNSS.
Ms. Brody, if you're there, if you could put yourself on the record and if needed, we can repeat the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Brody. I'm the Director of Healthcare Services for the State of Alaska, and it is actually the Division of Behavioral Health who prepared this fiscal note.
Okay, thank you. And who else, Mr. Zepp, did you think would be the person, Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could Ms. Brody answer the question on is this adding an optional service, and what's the difference between the optional services and the mandatory services?
Yeah. That was good. Yeah, I would appreciate that.
Ms. Brody?
Through the chair, this service is currently covered on our duly eligible recipients, those are that are eligible for Medicare and Medicaid both. So they are covered for these services already. We get the crossover claims from Medicare and pay them. So it would be adding a provider that can provide an already covered service.
Is there a follow-up, Representative Wilson?
Yeah. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. I'm sorry, because I mean, I understand that they can be seen in a clinical setting, so it's not as if marital family therapy isn't included at all. So I do understand that part. And from my understanding, this would make it to where if I had kind of my own shop to where they could just go there and they didn't have to go into a clinic, they can now get paid for Medicaid. So, but I guess what I'm wondering, and it's probably a legal question, not for Ms. Brody, is why then did this have to be added to AS4707030B if it's not adding to the optional services?
Ms. Brody.
Anybody who could answer, because well, maybe the sponsor can answer it because I can't.
Senator Wilson?
Yes, Chair Foster. I believe that the best person probably would be Rick Calcote from the Division of Behavioral Health, yeah. Or if Director Burns have joined him, maybe Director Burns would also be the most appropriate person to answer that question.
And if anybody would like to jump in on that, if you could just put yourself on the record and take a stab at that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. This is Rick Calcote with the Division of Behavioral Health. I'm currently the Chief of Risk and Research Management and oversee the systems and policy for the division. SB 74, our understanding, SB 74 expanded Medicaid to allow other licensed providers to be able to provide Medicaid services and be able to do that independently, bill independently for those services. If you'll notice in 4730, there is a number of other providers, if you will, psychologists, clinical social workers, and so on and so forth, that were listed there, and so they were automatically allowed to then be able to bill Medicaid independently. Licensed marriage and family therapists, and there's at least one other license, licensed professional counselors, who were not included. And so that's my understanding of why this language was now included in that statute, is to indeed allow them to then become independent providers of Medicaid services.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
Well, that was my point exactly. So we are adding the service with the rest of those that are currently listed. But my bigger question still is that on the fiscal note that was prepared, I'm just trying to find, 633 recipients is a pretty specific number. So are these 633 recipients that aren't receiving any service now? Are they receiving service from within a clinic setting that would then somehow go, you know, out to their to a private type setting? And then how many providers do we have that are sitting currently outside of the clinic setting that would now be able to bill Medicaid? Just trying to. This is one of our fastest growing areas is Medicaid, and now we're looking to add more to it, and I'm very concerned.
Through the chair, again, this is Rick Calcote. Thank you for that question. And how we arranged at this, that there is at this number of 633, there is an assumption built into the fiscal note that there are a number of people already currently being seen by the Medicaid system, and they are for behavioral health services, and they are being seen through physician's office, mental health physician clinics, our community behavioral health centers. And so when we are looking to expand the number of providers, those people then would probably see folks who are currently not being seen within the system. And we base that number on projected figures derived, as you can see here, from Medicaid prevalence data, which indicates that there are a number of unserved recipients. This is a phenomenon that occurs in every state. There are a number of people who are eligible for services but do not seek services for various reasons. We also then use the national average of when you look at the number of unserved recipients, the likelihood that any of them in any given fiscal year would actually seek services is about 10%. And so we use that number as the larger and possibly the greatest number of recipients that could possibly be served by expanding to a new provider set. And so that's why we came up with 633. The probability is that that number will be fewer.
So follow-up?
Follow-up.
So the question of how many providers out there currently are unable to be to charge Medicaid?
Currently, I'm sorry, through the chair, this is, again, Rick Kalko. I'm afraid I don't believe I can answer that accurately. There are currently a number of licensed psychologists, licensed clinical social workers, and if 105 were to pass, now obviously licensed marital and family therapists. I don't have the number of those people who are operating independently and or who are already gainfully employed through one of the other clinics who are currently billing Medicaid. So I'm not sure I can answer that question directly.
So to the sponsor, you know, I understand national averages, but if we're going to have a fiscal note that has 633 new people, because they're saying that these will do it, will not be the ones that are being served somewhere else as, besides those that would be moving over, how many providers do you think it would take to be able to service this 633 potential clients?
Senator Wilson?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, right now there's an estimate about 85 marital family therapists that are in the state licensed right now. With the changes of licensure, that's really going to be one of those unknown estimate numbers. And we're, even the physical note says they're unsure of the number of folks that be that would be able to independently bill Medicaid subject to their practices, documentations, audit requirements. And so it's going to be a personal choice of some folks. We do know that some industries, per se, like I said, through, let's say, the community, the FCAQs, the Federally Qualified Health Centers and community health centers, they are the ones that would be more likely to pursue some of these other licensed marital family therapists to be able to bill Medicaid and some of the other smaller practices for them. That number just really is an indeterminate number of how many folks that will, and I will, if there are some other folks that are licensed marital family therapists online that may be able to give more direct number of the folks that may be interested in starting practices just to see and to expand the Medicaid population. But like I said, this isn't adding new recipients to the program necessarily. These folks are already not being served. They're underserved. And so all this bill is doing is opening another door to make that line shorter to access behavioral health care services through SB 105.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'll just wait for public testimony. Maybe those who are listening to our debate can help us understand whether or not, if they're independent now, whether Medicaid actually pays enough to where they would want to go through all the paperwork to even be a recipient of Medicaid payments.
Sounds good, Representative Wilson. So with that in the lineup here, I have Representative Thompson and then Garrett and then Kawasaki. Representative Thompson?
I'll pass right now.
Representative Garrett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be interested to hear, as we hear from public testimony, but it's not like leaving family problems out there untreated is free. So, with the highest rate of repeat child abuse, with some of the highest rates of drug and alcohol abuse, all of which affect families and sometimes affect often the children in those families. As we hear the testimony, I think I wouldn't mind hearing what kind of costs might be avoided if we do this. We are not very good as a state when we write fiscal notes about talking about the costs that will be saved in the long run, but we probably don't have the numbers, but that would be useful because we have families that struggle from all of the worst numbers in the country that we've heard, from alcoholism abuse to drug abuse to sexual abuse to child abuse, and I think not doing this will probably cost us more, even though there's a fiscal note in front of us.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Just a quick question, if somebody can answer it. So currently, clinical social work services is part of that list for which Medicaid will reimburse, and it is an optional service. And I guess, are there cases in which a clinical social worker provides marital and family advice to a patient? I don't know who can answer that.
Senator Wilson, if you have any suggestions on who might, we've got quite a few people. I think we've got six people who are going to be doing invited testimony, by the way. So,
through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I'm not sure on the numbers. That's not my field of expertise, but there are some folks that are the folks from Association of Marriage and Family Therapists on the line, and a couple of other marriage and family therapists that are on the line that might be able to better answer that question in terms of licensed clinical social workers. But I can say that they are more, that number of practicing folks are fewer than the licensed marriage and family therapists, and maybe John Asana can talk to that number, and the recruitment of those folks are, there are fewer of them, they cost more because they're in such high demand for other practices and other services. The qualifying factors from that. I know the Department of Office of Social Services can testify to that as well, about how the shortage of that that field is, and the cost to recruit one of those individuals is so much higher than a licensed marriage and family therapist.
Thank you. And then I have another question.
Representative Kawasaki.
Just getting back to the question about whether this is an optional service that we are now adding or not. The fiscal note in the first couple lines, and maybe the person who's online from the department can answer it. The fiscal note line says that it would add marital and family services to the optional list of services to be reimbursed through Medicaid, and then it goes on to say that we're adding in AS 4707030 the list of Medicaid optional services for which the state will reimburse, I guess absent that, we wouldn't reimburse. I'm just trying to get past the whole idea that is this an optional service that we are now adding? And I've heard that, no, it's not really an optional service that we're adding, but it looks clearly that it is. And we can talk about the policy, about whether that's a good policy or not, but I just want to hear somebody definitively say that we are adding an optional service and it could potentially cost the state more in the future.
The only person I see online here from Hess is Ms. Margaret Brody or Mr. Rick Calcote. And so I don't know if either of you want to take a stab at that.
I think that $150 for that. I think part of it has to be paid for.
Right.
If we don't take care of it.
Sounds like no.
This is, through the chair, this is Rick Calcote with the Division of Behavioral Health.
It's about avoiding costs.
If I understand the question correctly, the addition of the provider in statute under 47.30 certainly will allow them to now provide and bill Medicaid services independently, so they no longer would actually have to work within a community behavioral health services provider or within a mental health physician clinic or a physician's clinic, and so they could bill independently. So there is, our assumption is that there is a small percentage of the Medicaid population who might seek those licensed independent practitioners out for continuing treatment. That would go on year by year. Exactly how much that will impact the Medicaid bill, we really don't know. Our best guess is what's included now in the fiscal note. I think that's the outside range. We would certainly know more after the first year or two as to, you know, the percentage of practitioners are actually seeing Medicaid clients and the number of Medicaid clients that are actually seeing them.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Again, so we're adding marital and family services to the optional list of services to be reimbursed through Medicaid. And that means that there's marriage and family therapists that work outside of the clinical setting that now, so they would be able to be reimbursed through Medicaid. So I think it's a yes or no question, but we are offering a new optional service for those folks, whereas they would not have been able to bill Medicaid prior to this bill passing. Was that correct?
Through the chair, this is Rick Calcote with the division. That is correct. That's my understanding.
Thank you.
And, yes.
Thanks.
Mr. Calcote, go ahead.
No, sir. I'm sorry. Thank you. I was just suggesting that perhaps Senator Wilson could confirm that. I don't necessarily put him on the spot.
This is, for the record, this is Gary Zapp, staff to Senator Wilson, and multiple conversations with Mr. Burns and the Behavioral Health Unit. That is my understanding as well. This bill, they're currently eligible in the community behavioral health clinics or physicians mental health clinic to bill Medicaid. If this bill were to pass, it would allow expand the capacity and services for a marital and family therapist in an independent practice.
And we have a question from Representative Seaton and then Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to get this straight as well. It's kind of two different things. One is that marital family and therapy services or service providers, they would be able to provide any of the services, whether it's clinical social worker service or psychologist services or anything else they're qualified for. And they could bill for that is one thing. And the other thing is that all of these other people, clinical social workers, psychologist services, even midwife services, if those people are qualified to provide marital and family services, then they could bill for that now, with this being an optional service. So is this a two-way street? In other words, the marital and family therapists will be able to bill, though I'm not sure that they can't already bill for anything that's provided for which they qualify for that's listed in the optional or mandatory services. And then this is so that anybody that's qualified can bill for marital and family therapy services. Is that correct? And I think I'm either Rick or Margaret Brody.
Through the chair, this is Rick Calcote. I'm sorry, I've gotten distracted here in the office. Could you repeat the question, please?
Sure. Two ways. One is we're kind of being told that marital and family therapists will now be able to bill for any services that they are qualified to provide that are covered, and that would include some things in clinical social worker services or psychological services and those things. But all of those other folks could now bill for marital family therapy services if they're qualified to provide those services as an additional optional service. Is that both of those things will be correct?
Through the chair, this is Rick Calcote. If I could try to clarify that, family psychotherapy is already an existing Medicaid service, and anyone who is qualified to provide that may do so. And by regulation, as well as statute, that's supported by any licensed provider in the state. Any behavioral health license provider in the state may be able to provide that as long as they have the requisite training, education, and experience. No one can, of course, call themselves a marital and family therapist unless they hold that particular license. By changing AS 47.30 as recommended by this current bill, all that does is just allow now licensed marriage and family therapists to actually bill Medicaid services.
And follow up?
Follow up.
But anyone else, whether it's a clinical social worker or a psychologist services or a psychologist, could with this in 030 could then bill for Maryland Family Therapy Services. Is that correct? Anybody that's qualified to provide those services could now bill for those services that are going to be covered on under 030.
Through the chair, this is Rick Halcote again. Yes, sir, that's correct. Anyone who is currently licensed in the state and is an approved Medicaid provider who is qualified to provide family psychotherapy or marital therapy could do so.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Looking through your slide presentation, it looks like we have a large shortage of therapists that would be able to work on it with people. This is trying to increase those number of people that are eligible that would be able to get paid for through Medicare. But I get the impression that so if we have more people available to treat, there would be possibly, and this is like the cost avoidance, a person would then be able to go to a therapist because it's going to be covered by Medicaid and it's going to be $150 an hour. If they don't get that treatment or have that ability or that available to them, I see where they're going to finally implode some and end up in the emergency room at $4,300 a visit or possibly be incarcerated. So I see this as a cost avoidance in some fashion. Is that true?
Yes. Senator Wilson, for the record, through the co-chair, yes, that is correct.
And if I may, this is Gary Zepp for the record as well, through the chair, Rep. Thompson. You're absolutely correct, and Margaret Brody can help address this as well. We've had multiple conversations and about when you look at the scale of clinical setting, the cost compared to what the cost is in emergency room setting, it's astronomically higher. And some of these clients right now, the Department of Health and Social Services has a fact sheet out from 2016 that it shows that $621 million was spent in our Alaska emergency rooms in 2016. 53.9% of those folks are Medicaid clients. If I can say, the potential is you're already paying for some of those clients right now, but you're paying in an emergency room cost because the first 23 hours is covered by Medicaid, and then thereafter it's picked up by the hospital.
Thank you.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. And I'm looking at the list and the participants and folks who support the bill. And let me just say I support the bill, too, I'm pretty sure. I just had a question, though, because I know marital and family therapists would like the ability to be able to bill Medicaid. That makes sense to me. Whenever we have a fight about TERF, though, like we're having difficulties with naturopaths, and if naturopaths now have prescriptive authority, like medical doctors do, from the medical doctor perspective, well, they don't have the commensurate education. But there's also that underlying thing where it's, you know, if naturopaths can finally get into the market, then it maybe means less for them. And we had the same fight, I mean, between rural dental aides. Can rural dental aides perform certain things? Well, dentists were, no, they can't, they don't have the education. And really what it boiled down to was just a matter, in my opinion, that, you know, it cuts their market. And so have we heard from any folks who are clinical social workers, psychologists, other folks, professional counselors who do currently bill for Medicaid that would be opposed to this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson speaking. No, we have not heard any opposition from those groups of folks that provide Medicaid services.
Good enough.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And expanding on Representative Thomas's comments on the avoidance cost issue, it's not so much, well, in addition to going to the hospital and not being covered, we're paying for it out of our insurance is covering it as well. But I want to ask Ms. Brody, there been reports done on the avoidance costs? Because we see a bill like this often enough, and it talks about, you know, the number of recipients that are available out there that will be covered. But it would be interesting to see, you know, the difference between somebody getting coverage and somebody going to the emergency room. And I know they're all just speculative numbers, but has there been any reports been on done on that in the past?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, no, there hasn't, because it actually cuts across a lot of different departments and divisions. You know, with the Office of Children's Services, children could be taken away. The state may be paying for the therapy that's required for people to get their children back. The Department of Corrections, as well as Medicaid and private insurance with the use of ERs.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Well, clearly I recognize that. It goes to the corrections. It goes to the Department of Law. It goes to the troopers, the courts, the family, the banks with the foreclosed, some, the whole nine yards. But I was just, and I'll do some Google searching myself to see if there's anything done on a national level. Thank you.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilson?
Yes. For what Representative Grimberg is asking for is a all claims database, payers database. Without that, it'd be really difficult to extrapolate that data out without a, the department just currently doesn't have that capability right now to do such a study or an item.
Okay. Any further questions on the bill? Representative Seaton?
And I guess it's either for Rick or Margaret Brody, but on the fiscal note, in the bottom paragraph, it's saying that there these services or their services are already being under the umbrella of a mental health physician clinic. Are you saying that mental health physician clinics are currently providing marital and family therapy services and are able to bill for marital family therapy services without that being a optional service, or do they bill it under another service such as psychological services or something else?
Hello.
Maybe Ms. Brody?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, they bill for services currently. All behavioral health services are optional services.
Representative Seaton?
Okay, but I'm trying to figure out how this is working now. Are some other providers billing for marital and family therapy services just under a different category?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that would be a question for behavioral health.
Okay.
And through the chair, Representative Seaton, this is Rick Calcote with the Division of Behavioral Health. You are correct. Currently, our community behavioral health centers, as well as our mental health physician clinics, are able to bill any behavioral health Medicaid clinic service, and that includes individual, group, or family psychotherapy. And so there are eligible providers, or, well, excuse me, qualified providers, if you will, in those provider agencies who are able to deliver those services, and that it's billed through Medicaid. However, it's billed against the psychiatrist's independent billing number for Medicaid, and in our Community Behavioral Health Services Center, it's billed against their billing number, their national identification provider identification number.
And thank you, and I think that's been some of the confusion here, so understanding that, that helps. And then the other thing, does this require a plan amendment? And is that on the fiscal note?
Through the chair, Representative, my understanding is that it does not require a state plan amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next up we have Representative Wilson and then Guerra. Representative Wilson.
So back to the fiscal note, the $50,000 for development of business rules in the Medicaid management information system seems pretty high, considering it sounds like we're already billing for most of these things, just this is outside of the clinical setting. Can you tell me how you came up with $50,000?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that is for the development of the business rules that would be required. Right now, the system is set up only to accept claims from Medicare, and so it has to be able to accept Medicaid-only claims also. And the system development for the MMIS system is extremely expensive.
I appreciate that, Ms. Brody. We've had a lot of parts of this. So just a question to the chairman. I'm very uncomfortable with this fiscal note from what we've heard today about how many are already getting a lot of the services from within. We're using some kind of national numbers to get there. I'm fine with the services that they want to be able to provide, and it sounds like they already are providing to the majority of these. But I wish, you know, since this bill's not moving today, I'm not sure amending the bill will help with the fiscal note, but maybe they could take a closer look at more Alaskan-centric versus national on, you know, or if they're going to do it this way, then at least there should be credit given if we're not going to be looking as much hospitalization or higher services that they have to come to. But it just seems like it's so one-sided, and I'd like to be able to see, you know, what the advantages are to be able to do that and what cost shifting that we will do with this bill. So it's a little bit more realistic. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And we do have a forthcoming amendment, so we will not be moving it today. And so if maybe the department could look at that further and try to address Representative Wilson's concern on that. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Calco, just on the fiscal note, I mean, I get that nobody can know exactly what the fiscal note's going to be. Am I right that the one of the unknowns is, I suppose it might be lower because some people who are already billing Medicaid by going to a psychologist or to a clinic to get these services might just bill the same amount of money by going to a private provider at their own office. On the other hand, with the growth in Medicaid use just because of the way the formula works, the longer you're in a recession, the more people end up on Medicaid statutorily just based on their income, that could grow it. And I take it those are two countervailing factors. You considered all of those in reaching these fiscal notes? For whoever's most familiar with the fiscal note.
Yes, through the chair, this is Rick Calco with the Division of Behavioral Health. Yes, there's a number of variables here that we certainly cannot specify completely. We don't know exactly the number of licensed marriage and family therapists who will then decide to actually see Medicaid clients. The 10% that are currently unserved, even though that is a national statistic, that is fairly well reflected within the state as well, historically, both for substance use as well as mental health. And so even though we may have 633 new people seek services, again, one of the factors is we don't know how many of those people will actually seek out independent providers as opposed to going to mental health physician clinics or community behavioral health services providers. And we don't know how many people who are currently receiving services would actually then terminate services within a calendar year. So is that helpful at all? Sorry.
Representative Guerra?
It is. So those are things that might lower the fiscal note. And on the flip side, the things that could countervail it would be recession continues, more people have lower incomes qualify you for Medicaid, so you might have people who formerly were not qualified for Medicaid but now meet the income guidelines, as we saw with the last year's budget. So It seems like there are those factors that could reduce the cost and those factors that could increase the cost, and my guess is you came up with a fiscal note that reflected all of that to the best of your ability.
Through the chair, this is again Raquel Cote with the division. Yes, sir, that is correct. That's our best shot.
All right, good enough. Thanks.
Thank you. And before we go to more committee questions, we've got about half an hour left before we need to get to the floor. We do have six people who have set aside some time of their day as we have invited them for testimony on this bill. I would like to get through them, give them the opportunity to say something. And so we're going to move over to invited testimony, and then we can come back to questions later. Because we have six people in about half an hour, if we could keep each testimony to under 5 minutes, if we could give a little bit of time for questions for each person, if that is so desired. Our first invited testifier is Ken McCarty, Director of the Discovery Cove Recovery and Wellness Center. And Mr. McCarty, if you could put yourself on the record and start with your presentation.
Hi, this is Ken McCarty, marriage family therapist. I'm from Eagle River. I am supporting this bill. I see over the past 9 years in exploring this whole piece of a great need, and even more so today. I travel all over the state as a speaker on addiction issues and see a great need throughout the state. Like I said, I was just in Barrow recently. We don't have enough providers. The question of how many providers would be available with the marriage family therapist, I did a survey back in 2013 of evaluating every one of the providers, what would you do? I found over 35% of the providers were already working for agencies that bill for their services. I found that of all the providers, there are some that were licensed in the state but outside the state, so they wouldn't be providing. But I found those that were interested in billing, being part of Medicaid, was only 8%. Well, at least that's 8% more providers there. Another piece is looking at SAMHSA efficacy of programs, and in the case of our opiate epidemic in the state, that the buprenorphine treatment is only effective with psychotherapy, psychosocial interaction, in addition to the physician or psychiatrist treatment of the medication. And I know at my agency, I have physicians that will not see clients if they're only getting the partial treatment. And that would make sense. You would go to the hospital with a car accident, and you have a fractured leg and lacerated, whatever, and the doctor says, we're only going to deal with the fractured leg. We'll deal with the laceration later. So this, you know, a big need that exists. The fiscal note is a very concerning thing. I run a for-profit business, and budget is a very strong concern of operation. We are in an economic challenge time. Question was asked by a couple senators back in 2013 when this was being explored in 2012, was what's going on in other states when they do inclusion of marriage family therapists? And I spent a lot of time looking at that and asking other states when they did the inclusion and several years later to see what their test budgets were like. And what I found was that there was no increase in the budget, and in some states there was a less of a budget because the expenses to, like, case API or emergency rooms or more intrusive interventions were not necessary because they were able to get treatment at an earlier point. So I'm strongly in favor of this, and if you have other questions, I'm open to answer them or try to.
Thank you, Mr. McCarty. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you. Thanks for testifying this morning, Mr. McCarty. I did just a really brief question, and if you can't answer it or just don't want to, that's fine too. What is your typical hourly rate if if I'm insured, pretty good insurance? What's that typical hourly rate?
Well, the hourly rate and what the insurance companies pay are two different things. So you have a usual and customary rate. For here, we disclose that, so it's not a secret. An hourly rate is $215. But I don't see that money coming in for those, as we are PPO for a lot of insurance companies. So usually we'll see something between 17 and 18% less of that. So, you know, 80% of that rate or somewhere just about that point.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
And then a second question, just since you're a provider that may, if this were to pass, you may take advantage of it. Are you aware of the billing requirements through Medicaid and the audit requirements, and is that something that you as a private business would take up?
For Discovery Cove, we're already recognized by the Department of Health and Social Services. Several years ago, they asked for us to be nationally accredited, and we did that process. I dumped tens of thousands of dollars towards that my expense to keep that profession status and such. So I think that that's not a problem from this end, and I would kind of expect that of other agencies that, you know, are being asked of doing Medicaid to demonstrate that they're a trustworthy entity.
Great. Thank you, Service. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. McCarty, for your testimony. Let's move on to the next person. We do have, I believe five people who are invited and then four people for public testimony. And so hopefully we can get to everybody before we adjourn for this morning. So the next person is Dr. Melissa Kimberling, Director of Programs, Matsu Health Foundation. Ms. Kimberling, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Dr. Melissa Kimberling, and I serve as Director of Programs for Matsu Health Foundation. The foundation shares ownership in Matsu Regional Medical Center and invests its profits back in the community in order to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in Matsu. So at Matsu Health Foundation, we do a community health needs assessment every 3 years. We feel like we're very in touch with the residents of Matsu. And for the past 6 years, they have been telling us that they face that the top health challenges they face are all related to behavioral health. So alcohol and substance abuse, number one, children experiencing trauma and violence is number two, and then followed by depression and suicide, domestic violence and sexual assault, and lack of access to behavioral health care. So the Senate Bill 105, which we are supporting, would expand the workforce that can provide this counseling to residents who have Medicaid. So I have a really vivid memory from the first needs assessment that we did when we went out to speak with school nurses from all over the borough. They insisted that we add to our list of health challenges lack of access to behavioral health services. This is because they were saying a wait of 4 to 8 months for children and families to get into see a counselor who accepts Medicaid. Unfortunately, nothing has changed in the 5 years since that assessment. There's still a long wait. The fact of the matter is that there are not enough mental health providers in Matsu. Currently, there's one provider to every 860 residents. A comparison to top counties in the U.S. That measure really well on this indicator is that they have one provider to every 330 residents. So, and there's even less mental health providers in Matsu who are able to see Medicaid patients. I think that, you know, there's been a lot of information given today about how this will save in the long run and people going to the emergency department. A couple points that weren't brought up is that, for example, at Matsu Regional Medical Center, there's absolutely no behavioral health care in the emergency department. So we're paying $4,370 for someone in behavioral crisis to go someplace where they just get stabilized, but they get no behavioral health care. And one other point to remember is a lot of times these people who are in crisis don't just go once a year. There's about 300 of them in Matsu who go five or more times a year. So that price of crisis care is very expensive for really no behavioral health care. Whereas if you add it up and that person early on saw a marriage and family therapist for $150 a session, that's about $1,500, that's a significant savings. So the prevalence of mental health and substance abuse problems in Matsu and Alaska is rising, as we all know, and one of the factors is the opioid crisis. We feel that this legislation could bring the appropriate level of care to people who need help when the problem first starts instead of after it develops into a crisis. So at the foundation, we're actively doing our part to build a behavioral health continuum of care that's fully staffed with caring professionals. We invest in our local nonprofits. We provide scholarships to train new behavioral health providers. We're trying to keep people out of expensive emergency rooms and institutional care and helping to keep our economy strong by providing local jobs. So we feel that SB 105 will help us to accomplish all of these things. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify on this.
And thank you, Ms. Kimberling. We have a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you very much for the testimony. I'm trying to follow the bill, and I'm not finding that the bill actually authorizes marital and family therapists to do anything. It says what they have to do to get a license, or clarifies that language, but they can already provide, if they're qualified, clinical social worker services or psychological services or those things. So I think, as I'm reading the bill, what it says is that anyone that's qualified can provide marital and family therapy services, is what's added here as a service that can be provided. But I'm trying to figure out, is there some other category of behavioral health, or are we just saying that marital and family therapy is a category that's not being sufficiently covered? I'm trying to match up the idea of the therapists themselves being able to provide services, which it seems like they already can, versus anyone that's qualified being able to provide these marital and family therapy services. So can you lead me through that?
Well, I can tell you what we see on the ground here in Matsu. So it is my understanding, and I'm sure, Rick Kelko can explain the ins and outs of this technically from the standpoint of DBH, but what I see on the ground here is that we have a handful of agencies that have counselors, including the marriage and family counselors, who are allowed to bill Medicaid. But if you're a marriage and family counselor out on your own, not under a federally qualified health center or a community behavioral health center, you cannot bill Medicaid. And in Matsu, the agencies, with counselors that are working with these families and providing this type of counseling, they don't have enough staff. And so they have waiting lists. So if we can open up the private providers, the marriage and family counselors that are on their own, to be able to see some of these families, it would really give a lot more access to our families who need this sort of care.
If they're providing and qualified to give rehabilitative services now, or services for individuals under 21 years of age, psychiatric facility services, or the psychologist services, if they're able to do that now, they would be able to bill Medicaid. But this would add the service of marital and family therapy. So if they're not qualified to provide those other services, they would only be able to bill for marital and family therapy. Is that your understanding?
As I understand it, what this bill allows it to happen is for the marriage and family counselors who are out on their own, not associated with a certain type of clinic, to bill for Medicaid.
For what services? Just for marriage? marital and family therapy?
I would defer to Mr. Calcote to answer that.
Okay, that's kind of our conundrum here, trying to understand exactly how this interrelation goes. So thank you. It looks like Senator Wilson.
Senator Wilson?
If I could clarify, I think Rick attempted to cover this his statement earlier. So the marriage and family therapist is a designated licensure which someone is qualified for through their education experiences and goes through the licensure process, then they're able under the regulations and our statutes to be able to bill for several myriad of items that are covered through that. And if Representative would like, we can send a list of sort of those CPT codes that they could be able to bill for under. So it's just not just marital family therapy per se, but it could be something for other behavioral health issues, anything that goes into the psychotherapeutic services of individuals and be able to, for the purposes of treating diagnostic, emotional, and mental disorders as well.
That would be helpful if you would provide the definition. Thank you.
Senator Wilson? I mean, Representative Wilson?
It's easy to confuse. So, but the clarification is, though, if I am a licensed marital family therapist currently and I am not within a clinic setting, I cannot, for any reason, bill Medicaid. But if this bill passes, I can, even if I'm doing things like drug therapy or anything that I have a degree to be able to do. But currently, if I am a marital family therapist outside the clinic, no matter what I'm doing, even if it's a service that falls underneath Medicaid, I cannot directly bill them.
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. If you're not, I want to say outside the clinic, outside a mental health community clinic. So they're their own private clinic. That's a little, I just want to separate those two.
Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have any further questions for Ms. Kimberling? Hearing none, thank you for your testimony. Next, let's move over to Dr. Ann Zink, emergency room physician at the Mat-Su Regional Hospital. If you're there, if you could just put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony. And it sounds like she might not be there. We can come back to her after the next testifier. Ms. Amy Spargo, Assistant Superintendent, Mat-Su Borough School District. If you're there, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is Amy Spargo. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Great. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of the Mat-Su Borough School District. I'm the Assistant Superintendent, and I recently have been most focused, as many assistant superintendents around the country, on school safety. And when we think about school safety, we really think about how do we increase access to behavioral health services for students who are in crisis, and how do we move upstream from that and provide preventative care for students who are experiencing trauma for a number of reasons and are unable to learn and function in school. Recently, we have a pilot program with the Mat-Su Health Foundation where five of our schools have targeted behavioral health wellness grants in schools, and we have partnered with community providers to work part-time in our schools and address some of the behavioral health needs of students and families. For us to be able to do that, we really need Medicaid-eligible providers just so that there's equal access for all families. What we're finding is that as we move to expand these programs of providing more services in schools, we just don't have enough Medicaid-eligible behavioral health providers in the Mat-Su Borough, as you heard Dr. Kimberling speak to. So SB 105 allows a few more of those private providers to be considered eligible under this plan and allow us a way to support families and children that have experienced trauma. I know that in 2000, you've been talking about how do you quantify preventative work. I know that in 2015, a study for the Center for Benefit Cost Studies in Education from Columbia University determined that each dollar spent on social emotional learning can return the equivalent of $11 in long-term benefits to students, families, and society. And we have certainly seen that if we can help students learn to self-manage and be able to demonstrate those kind of social and emotional learning skills, that the rest of their academic performance and things increase. And this is just another step in that direction. So the school district is very much in support of SB 105, and I thank you for this opportunity to weigh in.
Thank you, Ms. Spargo. Does the committee have any questions? And I don't see any, so thank you for calling in. Let's see, we'll go back to Dr. Ann Zink, if you're there. And it sounds like maybe not, so we will go over to Mr. Randall Burns, Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, Department of Health and Social Services, if you could put yourself on the record. And I don't see him on the list here, so maybe he is not available. Mr. Burns, I assume you're not there. So, Ms. Brody, I know you've been available for questions. I've also got you down here as invited testimony. If you would like, if you could just put yourself on the record again and proceed.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Margaret Brody. I'm the Director of Healthcare Services for the State of Alaska, and I did not have any testimony.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's see. I just want to give one more opportunity to Dr. Ann Zink or Mr. Randall Burns, if you're there. And hearing none, so that is our invited testimony for the day, and we will open up public testimony on HSB 105. And for anybody watching and who would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by sending an email to housefinance@akleg.gov. So with that, our first public testimony will go to Mr. Ben Shelton with the Alaska ASAP in Anchorage there. If you could put yourself on the record and proceed with your two-minute testimony.
Thank you. My name is Benjamin Shelton. I'm the president of the Alaska chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. That's Alaska ASAP. And we represent approximately 100 emergency physicians in the state. Clinically, I work in Anchorage. And I'm calling today to support SB 105. As a practicing emergency physician, I care for patients daily that are in crisis, and they often these crises are often secondary to mental health conditions. Too many patients have been unable to access timely outpatient care, which has led to their crisis. And timely outpatient care could have possibly prevented the deterioration of their conditions, which leads them to be a danger to themselves and to others. SB 105 increases access to needed outpatient therapy, and we support it because of that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Shelton. And for anybody who would like to submit written testimony, if you're calling in and the 2 minutes just isn't quite enough, feel free to send your testimony to us at housefinance@akleg.gov. I apologize. We have to get to the floor in about 10 minutes. And so with that, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Jocelyn Pemberton, if you're there calling in from Anchorage, if you could put yourself on the record. Ms. Pemberton, are you there? We'll come back to her. Ms. Laura Evans, calling in from Virginia, if you're there, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Laura Evans, and I'm the State Government Affairs Manager for the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. We are the professional organization for marriage and family therapy and marital and family therapists. We represent approximately 62,000 MFTs in the U.S., including those in Alaska. I wanted to kind of hit on some notes that I think that the committee may have discussed and provide our perspective. AAMFT supports Senate Bill 105 because we believe it will expand access to mental health services that are already covered by Medicaid, but simply allowing a different provider choice. We have a study, and I would be happy to share that information with the committee regarding utilization. So that offset that the committee discussed, we found in a study that if you looked at the 6 months of healthcare utilization before marriage and family therapy and then after, there's a decrease of about 21.5%. So we are seeing that people are taking better care of their health generally because they are getting mental health care treatment and not going into the emergency room. Regarding the fiscal note, we would argue that cost for adding a marital and family therapist would be minimal, if at all, since the service is already covered by Medicaid and we're simply offering a different provider. So we're offering another choice. And that 10% that was referenced for increase in recipients, because Medicaid is an entitlement program, that 10% would come whether or not marital and family therapists are a part of the program. So that 10% may come out of the woodwork to have services from clinical social workers or another group. We are just providing another provider to deal with that 10% coming out of the woodwork. I would also like to note that marital and family therapists are clinical providers. They are licensed. Once they are licensed in Alaska, they are allowed via statute to diagnose mental and behavioral disorders and provide treatment for that. Where it differs from other professions is that marital and family therapists use a systemic or holistic perspective, so that our members believe that these disorders do not occur in a vacuum, and so that's the relationship within a family or a couple or other relational dynamics affects that person's mental or behavioral disorder. And so that's where the name marriage and family therapy comes from. But the services that our members provide are all clinical. And of course, the services that are covered by Medicaid would not cover non-clinical services. So if a person is in private practice and they are treating someone for depression or substance abuse, and that's a covered service, then that person can now bill through Medicaid if this bill is passed, whereas we are not asking for a non-clinical service to be added or other services to be added to the Medicaid program. We're just simply allowing our members who provide that service to do so and bill independently so that they can have a private practice if they so choose.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Evans. Do we have any questions from the committee?
Yes, one question.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry if this has been answered, but for the definition of family therapy, if you have, let's say, a child who needs help or one parent who needs help, so they go in by themselves, is that considered family therapy, even though more than one person doesn't come in?
Through the chair to the representative, thank you for that question. I'm not a clinician, so that may be better suited for a clinician. However, our marriage and family therapists see individuals and family, and so that's just simply, I think, a billing situation of what are you billing it under, what diagnostic code. There is a family therapy diagnostic code where there are other people involved, but if you're seeing just an individual because of their depression, you would bill that under the code for depression and how long the session was.
Thank you.
Is my understanding.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. And our last testifier today that's on the list is Mr. John Sadada. If you could put yourself on the record.
Good morning, Chair Foster and members of the committee. My name is John Sadada. I'm the policy director for the Alaska Primary Care Association. We are the Association of Alaska's Federally Qualified Health Centers. We provide behavioral health care that's integrated with medical services in most of our facilities. Our focus in this specific area is generally on individuals with mild to moderate behavioral health concerns that are frequently related to care being provided for chronic conditions, including diabetes and hypertension, amongst others. These activities operate outside of the community behavioral health system. We cannot currently bill for services provided by LMFTs in our federally qualified health centers. Expanding the Medicaid billable behavioral health labor force is the number one priority of Alaska health centers and has been for the last 2 years. We support SB 105. Health centers have made major investments in behavioral health integration and have greatly grown our behavioral health practices integrated with our medical practices. We have a chronic and very serious shortage of billable providers, In a labor force survey that we did late last year, we are able to document a current shortage of between 12 and 18 FTE providers in Alaska's health centers, with some positions open for as long as a year. Full staffing of, by LMFTs along with other behavioral health provider types would greatly enable health centers to serve a wide variety of patients in conjunction with the medical services that they receive. I think with that, knowing that you're short of time, I would be open to any questions, and we will submit our full testimony to the committee. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Zadata. And with that, if anybody has any questions, maybe if they could contact him and share that with the committee. We do need to get down to the floor. I just would like to announce that we do have an amendment that a member would like to submit, and it needs to be drafted up. And so I'd like to set an amendment deadline for 9 a.m. Tomorrow, Friday, April 13th. If that could be submitted to Jane Pearson in my office. If anybody else has got one, please do so. And let's see here. I'd like to bring this bill back up tomorrow after we get that amendment. This afternoon or this morning, we also had the spill bill that was scheduled, and that is SB 158, oil hazardous cleanup reimbursement. And I intend to bring that up at this afternoon's meeting. And at that meeting, which is at 1:30 April 12th today, we'll have three other bills: SB 37, pharmacy board and staff; SB 15, e-cigarettes; SB 155, real estate appraisal management. And with that, if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we will be adjourned at 10:59 a.m. Thank you.